But you can either use the up down arrows or the mouse.
So I'm going to go ahead and start. You folks have important things to do, as same as we do. And so I'm going to open this meeting. This is the Joint Committee on IT for Ways and Means. And this is the 7th of April. And I have to look around and make sure I'm saying that right. And Sean, tell us what we're going to do today.
Chair Riley, for today, we have two agencies before us, the Oregon Employment Department and the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. Both agencies are planning to give us an agency IT overview. And first up, we have the Oregon Employment Department. If you could come on up. Yep. And please remember to state your name for the record.
Welcome.
Co-Chair Riley, for the record, my name is Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. And we're here today with Gerald Ferenkopf, who is the Employment Department's Chief Information Officer, and we want to do an overview of our technology system, including some of our less reputable moments, and give the committee a clear idea about how we're organized and where we're going and what we have intended for the future. Our agency goals are so that Oregon residents have the skills they need to succeed in jobs and that our businesses have the workers they need to succeed in having those businesses grow, that we have an aligned workforce system, that we're getting the most out of every dollar we get, and that we have an effective and efficient unemployment insurance system. So, to achieve these goals, we need a variety of technology programs, and currently you're probably aware that many of those are old and heading towards dysfunctional, so we're looking for a lot of innovation there. Gerald will describe the specifics. I've been in this role about 18 months. Gerald, about
20 months. Yeah?
Okay, so it's your fault. No. In that time, we've looked to seriously rebuild the IT capacities. That was one of the top priorities I was given by the governor when I first started. And clearly, due to some of the challenges the department had faced in IT previously, it was a very serious need. Another part of that is retooling the unemployment insurance process. In the past, we have sort of let our IT bright ideas lead the way rather than our business. And so we're retooling our businesses in order to be able to tell our IT partners exactly what we need. But as you know, we have outdated systems and processes. Unemployment insurance, we've been in that business about 82 years. And over that time, processes have been layered upon processes as the feds have changed requirements and rules. We are in a process right now with some lean experts taking it apart and getting down to what's really important. So our key unemployment insurance modernizing elements are document management, tax auditing, tax and wage information processing, claims management, overpayment, and collections. So when we talk about that UI system, it's convenient to just talk about it as one big system, but in reality, there are many parts to it. This is the organizational framework of how our system works. We have, in addition to unemployment, down at the bottom of the chart, you'll see we also have WorkSource, where IT plays a big part in that. And we also have our research department, which provides the labor market information. So those all play into and with connected to unemployment insurance records. Unemployment insurance area has 629 positions divided into three areas, benefits, tax, and policy. There's the Office of Administrative Hearings, which has 111 positions. They resolve tax appeals for 60 agencies in the state. About two-thirds of those cases are from the Employment Department. About two-thirds of their time is spent outside the Employment Department. Our Job Services Division provides businesses through our Business and Employment Services area. They have 467 positions located in 39 field offices throughout the state, as well as the Salem Central office. And then our labor market section has 62 positions. So total, we have about 1,300 employees. It's often confusing to people, I know it was to me when I first started, how the state organizes its various roles in workforce development, and that's what this chart is to a shot at trying to help you understand. So you see OED with the three areas I just spoke of. But also very important in the workforce system is the federal funding that comes in to help retrain dislocated workers, train low-income and challenged workers and low-income youth. So those programs are with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, soon to be the HEC. We have formed an interagency department that administers those federal funds jointly. It's become kind of our department's R&D area. It's got both OED and CCWD employees because we're all engaged in the WorkSource enterprise and in getting people back to work. The HEC, of course, has the universities, community colleges, student financial aid, and their own research and data capacities, and the rest of CCWD, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, GED, and Adult Basic Skills. BOLI also plays a very important part in workforce development in its apprenticeship division. We're working closely with them to try and identify occupations formerly not considered apprenticeable or not involved in apprenticeship that can be put into the mix because that's a very cost-effective way of doing training. We work with the Department of Human Services on their self-sufficiency program as well as vocational rehabilitation, bringing more people back into the workforce, making taxpayers out of tax consumers, and finally with the Commission for the Blind. So all of these agencies play a role in workforce development. A few months ago, the governor put OED in the lead to try and coordinate these efforts among state agencies. And I'm going to turn it over to Gerald now for what you really want to hear about.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Riley, committee members. My name is Gerald Ferenkopf, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Employment Department. This slide is our org chart for IT, and while you've probably seen many of these like this, 18 months ago, this is not how we looked. As many of you may be aware, IT had a history of dysfunction and failed projects. So one of my primary responsibilities when I came on board was to turn us back into a highly functioning organization. I spent a little over a year now restructuring while continuing to keep the business moving forward, and that's to meet the needs of the agency, our partners, businesses, and of course customers, Oregonians. We have aligned OED IT to help serve the constituencies of the agency. And for each of the major functions you see up there, the systems manager, application manager, security, and modernization manager, we've hired new managers. And I've also just recently hired a brand new deputy CIO started the end of March, who's in the room right now. We have surveyed our staff to better understand their current skills and their interests, and we'll now be moving forward to train in needed areas as we move forward. And we have been and will continue to address our processes, procedures, and our standards. This slide represents the IT portion of the agency's operational budget. In the 2011 biennium, IT was 8% of an agency overall operational budget of $444.2 million. And we actually had $37.2 million for IT. This was probably high, but we had a lot of large projects in that biennium. In the 13-15 biennium, the portion of IT was 10% of the operational budget. And this increased because we moved out child care from the agency, which decreased our overall agency's operational budget to $296.7 million. So our actual IT expenditures is down to 30.3 compared to the 37.2 the previous biennium. And in the 15-17, we go back up to 15%. A piece of that, again, is because we had proposed moving out the Office of Administrative Hearing from the agency, which would reduce our overall budget to $267.5 million. We're about $40.1 million. Again, we have some pretty large projects that we want to do in this biennium, this next biennium. Personal services was $13.5 million for 65 positions. And SNS was $22.2 million. 12.5 was for the SDC. We had $5.3 million for software licenses and maintenance. We had $3 million for PC replacements. We had $1 million planned for position-related SNS and about $400,000 for phone equipment replacement. This slide represents some wins for the agency and for IT, supporting our overall goals of modernizing services for our customers. Employers can now pay their delinquent tax balances, or customers can pay their claim overpayments on an online system 24/7. At this point in time, we have recovered about $2 million, a little less than $2 million, from 3,754 claimants, and about 271,000 from employers using this online tool. In the middle there is business intelligence. This sits on top of our data warehouse. And this actually has been instrumental in helping us decrease our claim fraud. The tool allows us to more readily identify fraud. And in the past year, we have identified 81 cases of fraud and recovered 256,000 by using this tool.
Yes, Senator Whitson.
Thank you. In your collection activities, do you interface with the Department of Revenue?
Yes, we do.
In what fashion?
They have access into our mainframe to gather data. And if I need more detail, I'll have to get you that answer for later, but I know we do have an interface into our system.
I would like to know a little more about that. We're actually working on a statewide collection deal, so.
Someone else is taking those notes.
Okay. This business intelligence system also helps us by automating a lot of reports that were manually done through a spreadsheet system, both for us and for the federal government. The last on the right there is the Office of Administrative Hearing Case Management. We have completed phase one by rolling it out to OAH and the Employment Appeals Board, the EAB. This project is now started in phase two. We need to complete that rollout to about 70 other agencies, boards, and commissions. To date, we have about 20,000 cases that have utilized this this tool. The next couple of slides are some projects completed in 2013-15. I'm not going to go over each one of them, but if you have questions, I'll be happy to address them. The majority of these projects added value to the agency by automating processes or reducing manual intervention. One of the big wins for the agency was in the Unisys and imaging upgrade projects. Before we completed those, our imaging system was down about every other week, and there was a lot of manual intervention to keep it going and make it work. So now that we've got these two pieces working, we can now schedule to modernize this in line with where it needs to fall into the future instead of having to address it right away. Another one I'll highlight is the Work Opportunity Tax Credits for employers. These are federal tax credits that provide employers with incentives to hire certain groups of people. A large portion of those are veterans. And to date, we've cleared a backlog and doled out $259 million in tax credits to employers in the state of Oregon. And the last one I'll talk about on this page, unless you have questions, is the Treasury Offset Program, which is TOPS. And this is an automated way for us to recapture delinquent overpayments from claimants by automatic deduction from their federal tax returns. And since this was implemented in 2013, we've collected over $10 million in funds. This next slide is some more projects. I'm really going to focus on the internal ones. I want to identify that when I started 20 months ago, OED was on a third-party email system. And in just recently in this biennium, we have moved to the state data center, or the state's email system. That's been successful. We're all on it, working quite nicely. Another one is we were one of the agencies with lots of Windows XP up to just recently, and we've migrated off of XP onto Windows 7, so we're in good shape there. And then we've also brought in Microsoft technicians to help us look at our Microsoft environment, and we've made a number of changes to that environment to help us with security. And another one I'll focus on is we've rebuilt and are improving our project management office for IT. We've standardized on some templates. We're working with the state CIO's office on their portfolio management tool, which will hopefully take our projects in. We're working with them on that, though. And we have been and will continue to use the stage gate process from the state CIO's office.
So one of the things that was mentioned earlier is that you're moving from a IT-driven shop to a business-driven shop. What part of the shop is done, the process analysis and business analysis?
We actually have business analysts identified in various groups within the business that will work with IT on a go-forward basis. So when we do projects, we get them engaged up front in the requirements analysis, work with them to make sure IT understands what they're trying to get at. We'll then provide options and a recommendation. And assuming if that goes through the stage gate process, then we have to do business cases, which the business helps us with, get state CIO stage gate approval before we move forward.
Thank you.
Some major projects for 2015-17. I'll start with modernization. What we'd like to do is start with planning and feasibility. And the reasons for this are our systems are very old. They're written in legacy programming languages. It's hard to find the resources and hire them. Systems are actually very sensitive. Even minor changes to legacy systems usually causes us problems in other systems, even when we didn't intend to. And then the systems over the many years, these are COBOL mainframe systems, are highly dependent on each other. And so when we change one, we often end up impacting another without ever really intending to. And it would help if we modernize our systems. And lastly, I'll mention that integration suffers from the same dilemma, which is it often takes more time to do the integration and it becomes less reliable because they're so intertwined and dependent on each other. I believe a modernized system will help alleviate a lot of this. Next up is the Oregon Payroll Reporting System, and this is a project that makes our web-based payroll system accessible to Oregon businesses. Currently, they use a PC-based system, which was written in Access 97, which is no longer supported, hasn't been supported for a very long time. And there's a lot of manual intervention by the agency when businesses try to upload their taxes. So we'd like to modernize that and replace it with a web-based system. Next on the list here is the Office of Administrative Hearing, and we've completed phase one in this biennium. We've started phase two, which is to roll the case management software out to the rest of the agencies, boards, and commissions. There's about 70 of them. We know it'll cross into the next biennium, so we're needing to list that as a project for 2015-17. Yeah.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I have actually two questions on the OHA. First, does it interface with the e-court?
The DMV, Department of Justice e-court? No, it does not. Sorry, we called it e-court when I first started.
Well, the judicial branch's new e-recording, electronic recording system.
Doesn't interface to it, to my knowledge.
Okay. And the second thing, on your phase two, are you going to create a body of precedential cases of in administrative law for the administrative law judges?
No, not to my knowledge.
Co-Chair Riley and Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, my understanding is that they publish the cases that they believe set precedent on a regular basis, but I'm not sure to what extent that's involved in this computer upgrade, but that is a typical practice for that part of the organization.
Follow up. I actually sit on the oversight committee, and we've been trying to get that accomplished for some time to get some consistency in. I know that administrative law is supposed to be more discovery than it is judicial, but for those people in the system, it seems pretty judicial. And so they were, the idea is to try to establish a bank of precedential decisions so that an administrative law judge can look at it and say, this is what's been done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The next one up, if I'm moving along here, is security. We have a number of security packages we'd like to implement in the next biennium. We'll stage them not all at once, but through the next biennium. And that will address a lot of our security weaknesses we've identified. And last one I'll talk about on here is the call center upgrade. And that's a federally funded project to update our call center, UI call center software, unemployment insurance call center software and hardware. And that's out of warranty at this point. So we need to get that updated. This slide is really trying to represent the foundation for IT and the agency moving forward from the bottom up. Our overarching principles for IT need to be in support of the agency's strategic plan, mission, vision, and values. And part of restructuring was to support that that goal. Going forward, our plan is to strive towards providing modern services with a buy versus build model. Which means that we're going to be looking for an opportunity to invest in modern technology to roll out to our customers. IT has created its own strategic plan that's in support of the agency's strategic plan, mission, vision, values, and goals. And in addition, each of us in the functional IT organization has created our work plans to make sure we make progress towards that strategic plan. It's a more operational view into our strategic plan. My new IT management team is in support a shift in the culture to a customer service first mentality, and we are committed to building better systems through improved processes, procedures, and standards. That's that bottom foundational piece. And then the next layer up, we've been working on rebuilding and improving our project management office for IT projects. In addition, we recently as an agency have established a governance committee to make sure we're working on the right projects at the right time.
And who serves on that governance committee?
Members from all the business units, and the chair is an executive for the agency, and then I'm there for the IT part, but play really just another role.
It's
really driven by the business. In support of executive management, by the way, they put team members on there. They selected them. So we also are looking at that next layer up is enterprise architecture. And this I consider the we need a blueprint for what we have, what we need, and how we're going to get there. And these pieces are what's going to allow us as an agency to move forward, IT and the agency to move forward, in my estimation. No questions, I'll move along. Some of the strategic challenges I believe we've faced in the time I've been here. Over the last 18 months, it has taken me much longer than planned to find and hire resources. And I, as my slide earlier, each functional area has a new manager hire that took longer, and then I just recently was able to get a deputy CIO on board. And then finding, sometimes it takes us a very long time to find a COBOL resource at all. I mean, I think I asked you, Senator Co-Chair Riley, to, if you'd help out.
If I'd be willing to come over and help, yeah. In my spare
time.
You
offered your book.
In my spare time.
Yeah. Over the years, server patching system and security patches have been put on the back burner to development and projects. And I believe this has contributed to a large and significant backlog of deferred maintenance for IT and the agency. So with ongoing business, we still got to move the agency forward. With the added deferred maintenance and with new projects, I think our schedules are ambitious, but very doable and necessary for us to move forward as an agency.
Senator Whitsitt.
I think, what is your time schedule? And the reason I ask is, I think the Department of Justice is looking at 9 years and the Oregon Health Authority 8 years, and I can go on, but I mean, that's really not acceptable. How quickly can you do this and do it right?
Good question. Our approach actually working with the state CIO and LFO is to break this into smaller chunks. So we're going to start with a high-level plan, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And that'll give us a better idea how quickly we think we can go. We're a large, fairly large agency as far as application goes, so it's probably going to be multiple bienniums or at least multiple years.
And Co-Chair Riley and Senator Whitsitt, I share your concern. The first estimate they gave me of time, I had a heart attack, and we're working on what's real and trying to prioritize that. So we'll be back to you as we get those time frames squared away a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. We actually had a conversation with LFO today on that same thing. I mean, it's there is certainly we've had bad experiences with IT projects. We need to do it right, but we also need to do it right before, so that it's done before it's obsolete.
Yes, and I think part of that for us is, as Gerald mentioned earlier, is that to the extent feasible, purchasing things off the shelf. We're fortunate to be one of 50 states doing unemployment insurance, and we're waiting and watching for their tools as they become the new monetization tools as they come online. So I think that process will be much quicker than it's been in the past where we've done that development ourselves. Of course, there's adaptation. But.
Moving into the POPs, first up is POP 101, which is Modernizing Business Services and Technology Infrastructure. We define modernization as reevaluating an alignment of our systems to include technology, service delivery, and administration. The focus would be on leveraging and streamlining our policies, processes, and technology to efficiently deliver services to our customers. First steps for me, and I recommend to the agency, is for us to make sure we have a fully functioning project management office for IT projects. Having a fully functioning governance committee to make sure we're working on the right projects at the right time, and then a blueprint for helping us understand what we have, what we need for the future, and how we're going to get there. And that's the enterprise architecture I talked about earlier.
And what's the ask for this POP?
This POP is $3 million, and we're working with LFO to make sure we're right-sizing this and taking the right approach. And that's to get us through the high-level planning phase, hire contractors, temps, consultants.
Okay.
And then we're going to start with the high-level plan I just mentioned. Assuming stage gate approval from state CIO, that's when we'll move into some more details. Some of the things we'll ask consultants to help us with is a feasibility study. We'll ask them to help us build our program management office for modernization, some project management help. We'll also look at technical architecture assistance, and then, of course, quality assurance. This will be large enough. We'll want to make sure we have quality assurance. Some of the things we'll be looking at is we'll go out in this high-level plan phase, is we'll look at available solutions out there, what's out there. We'll then compare our needs to those solutions we found. As Lisa pointed out, as our director pointed out, We will follow a buy versus build model. We'll look at other states that have successfully implemented something, making sure that it's scalable and that it has addressed security for today and into the future whenever possible. And then right after the high-level plan, assuming we get approval, we'll drop into detailed planning. And we don't know what that looks like yet, but we're likely to start in the unemployment insurance tax area. But it could change depending on the outcome of the high-level plan. And we believe a lot of the issues we're having as an agency will be solved with a modernized system. And I would like to highlight that we have been working very closely with LFO on this particular plot. So. Next up, sorry these aren't in order, I got out of order here, is POP 106, which is the Oregon Payroll Reporting System 2.0, or OPRS. When I first started, OPRS was one of several failed projects. While the back end of OPRS, where all the data lives, was functional, the secure front end was overly complex and too difficult for our staff and customers to use. So this was put on hold until we could figure out how to fix it.
So what is the back end? What's the language and the structure?
The very, very back end is an Oracle database. Mm-hmm. The actual, what I'm referring here is the back end, is a vendor that built using Cold Fusion. Actual collects all the data, knows the roles, passes okay. things back through. It's Cold Fusion.
Okay.
We're asking, this POP is at, it's a $1.6 million ask, and we're looking to spend the money to only do a new simplified secure front end to that back end that exists. And of course, we'll follow the stage gate process from the state CIO. And once approved, we'll actually send an RFP out to ask vendors to supply that secure front end utilizing the existing back end. POP 104 is agency security compliance. Again, 20 months ago when I started, it was pretty well known that we had security issues, and we've been identifying those and putting a plan in place. This POP is intended to enhance our IT security. When we wrote this POP, which didn't seem that long ago, we had stated we hadn't had a breach. Well, that is no longer true. We've had a breach. But we have a plan for updating security, which includes the software tools outlined in this POP. We are committed to continual assessment of our security needs for better monitoring, detection, and prevention. And of course, we'll test our applications and systems for security before we ever release them. And any of the tools on this POP, I'd like to point out, will be going to the Enterprise Security Office to make sure we're in compliance and that they make sense. So if this POP is approved, we'll address many of our weaknesses that we currently have identified. There's a list of 8 tools on here. I'd like to not go into them by name,
please, but don't.
I'm happy to talk in general terms if you're interested.
That's fine.
POP 139 is the Office of Administrative Hearings, Case Management. This POP is asking for us to be able to spend money to complete Phase 2. It's already started, but we know it'll roll into this next biennium, and we need to complete it. As I talked about earlier, Phase 1 was for Office of Administrative Hearing and the Employment Appeals Board. That's been completed. They're utilizing it. But we need to roll it out to the rest of the 70 so agencies, commissions, and boards. It's our intention to complete this in the 2015-17 biennium as well. That's about a that is about a $837K ask for this POP to complete that. That's all I have today. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm open to questions at this point.
So, Representative, do you have any questions?
I have just a series of questions that I don't expect you to have the answers on the top of your head, but we're actually said we're working on a debt collection thing, and we know that the Employment Department is the fourth largest holder of delinquent and liquidated debt among the state agencies. So I'd like to know what the amount of that debt is, whether it's growing, whether it's reducing, your percentage of write-off, not too detailed, but kind of an overhead description of how you go about collecting that. I'd really appreciate that.
All right. I do not have that off the top of my head, so we will get you those answers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Sean?
All right. Chair Riley and members of the committee, next up we have the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. Why don't you come on up? And again, if you can, please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Let's put this between us. I'm ready to roll. Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we're here today to provide you an overview of our technology systems and some key issues facing us. With Representative Nierman accepted, we don't deal with many of you in our in substantive committees or in the Ways and Means process regularly, so I thought I would start by just talking a little bit about what the agency does and how we do it to set some context for the technology systems we have and investments we make. Department of Consumer and Business Services is the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Our mission is to serve and protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. We do that in a variety of ways, largely organized around managing the state's worker safety system. This consists of Oregon OSHA in the prevention and enforcement area, as well as the Workers' Compensation Division and Workers' Compensation Board, dealing with issues for workers when they become injured on the injured or sick on the job. Consumer protection, which takes a couple of guises, we deal through the Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities with the issue of financial safety and soundness of institutions that consumers rely on, banks, credit unions, insurance companies, those kinds of things who have to be able to make good on consumer claims that they may have, as well in both those divisions regulating the behavior of various kinds of entities. You've given us a variety of regulatory authorities over the years to license and regulate a whole variety of activities from those companies like insurance companies and banks to mortgage lenders, mortgage loan servicers, pawnbrokers, and any other number of consumer, typically financial kinds of organizations. And then we're also responsible for building safety as well as consumer protection through the Building Codes Division, where we establish statewide construction standards and also license skilled construction tradespeople, plumbers, electricians, those sorts of things. We also directly permit and license technical kinds of construction installations around the state, boilers, elevators, those kinds of things. We also regulate the state wide system of cities and counties building departments, and so 130 cities and counties throughout Oregon have elected to assume responsibility for delivering building services at the local level, and we establish the standards that they need to follow to be able to do that. However, in some parts of the state, we remain the local service deliverer. So, for instance, in Umatilla County and Coos County, we are the local building department for the unincorporated parts of the county and for certain small cities, and deliver those services directly. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of scale, the agency has a bit more than 900 employees and a budget that you can look at in a couple of different ways. We have a core operating budget of about $200 million. We have about an equal amount of non-limited funds that are the worker benefit funds. These largely pay workers' compensation insurance companies an adjustment for benefits for injured workers to make up the difference of inflation from the time a worker was injured to the time that they collect benefits. And so if you count those non-limited funds in our budget, it's about a $400 million budget. We are almost entirely funded by fees and assessments on the industries that we regulate and thus their customers. There is some small amount of federal funding in the agency, a bit in the in Oregon OSHA through the Federal Department of Labor, and a bit in the Insurance Division, largely through grants related to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and in our case specifically some narrow issues related to rate review. When I get to the end of the presentation, I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 1 and the implications of bringing Cover Oregon's functions into the department, but in sort of the base description of what we do, that hasn't fully taken effect yet, and so it's not part of the numbers I just talked about. So if you go back in time, three and a half years ago when I started as the director, I think it's safe to say that our IT environment at that time was dissatisfying to those of us as customers in the system and those who were working with it. We didn't have a track record or even individual cases of catastrophic IT failures or anything like that, but we had a system that had a lot of issues. It had issues around dissatisfaction with priority setting, questions of what was the appropriate way to approach governance. We had projects that were difficult to be brought in on time or in the fashion that they were expected, and so we worked to make significant changes in reshaping and reevaluating those governing processes and those systems for delivering that largely under Sandy Wheeler's leadership. I'll turn this over to her actually shortly. But I'd like to talk a little bit about sort of some of the key building blocks of what our IT strategy is today. When we approach IT projects, we typically try to identify ways to break reasonably large projects into small, self-contained components. I should say that in the main, we're not a generator of monstrous tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of size IT projects with a potential couple of exceptions. So when we're talking about breaking a large project into smaller projects, our version of large is probably pretty small compared to most agencies. But the idea is to figure out what are the things that are self-contained that we can deliver so that we can either, if we're going to fail, it's going to be a fairly self-contained kind of a failure, but more typically that we can deliver functional pieces at a pace and be able to build success. And I'll talk about a couple of projects that particularly do that. We have very much moved away from a culture of building our own I'm sure you've heard this over and over again in these presentations, to a culture of buying off-the-shelf or software as a service when we're able to. We're not quite as blessed as the employment department, who you heard from earlier, in terms of 49 other states that do more or less the same thing, but we do operate in a lot of spaces where there are a lot of folks who do similar kinds of things, and so we're able to take advantage of those kinds of investments and take advantage of the fact that there are systems and products available in the space that we operate frequently. I don't want to touch on each and every one of these building blocks, but the last one I do want to talk about is rethinking how we do governance. We implemented an agency-wide governance process which had not really existed in a fully developed form, and so we've refocused our work and we've reorganized our staff to be able to deliver that. A couple of other general overview things about technology. If you're familiar with some of the reports that have gone by about state core functions, we're not atypical in that we have a great many legacy systems that are written in old and dying languages that require, if you looked at our mix of investment, we underinvest in technology and overinvest in staff, which is consistent with the pattern that you see in other agencies because of the need to maintain those legacy systems. Our strategy over time, as I said, is to move off those internally built legacy systems and move on to COTS and software as a service. But right now, we still have that kind of a profile. Today, we're staffed at 74 FTE. We have organized our research and our information technology staff into a single subunit of our central services division. 59 of those staff are our core IT. That 74 number, just in comparison, in the 2009-2011 biennium was 94 staff, and so we've become considerably more efficient over time as we try to improve our processes and systems in this area. With that, I'd like to introduce our Chief Information Officer, Sandy Wheeler, who will talk in a little bit more detail about how we're staffed and organized to deliver services.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, for the record, my name is Sandy Wheeler. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So first, I'd like to spend a little time talking about the staff that makes up the IT organization. The first team I'll talk about is the system support team. They support the day-to-day operations of our business systems. They're very closely aligned with the divisions that they support. They provide a high level of understanding of both the business systems as well as the business processes in which that they support. These staff include our business liaisons, which are the bridge between the IT organization and the business. They also include a business analyst and a system support specialist. The system support specialist is a technical person who keeps the systems running and deals with the day-to-day issues that come up. Next, I'll talk about the project delivery team. They're actually separated from the system support staff, and that was a change that we made as we looked at our organizational structure. And the reason for that was that we were seeing a challenge in where if the project folks are being asked to deal with day-to-day issues, they weren't able to focus on the delivery of those projects. So we actually separated the team so that these folks are solely focused on the delivery of projects that go through our governance process. These folks make up our project managers, our systems analysts, our system designers, and our developers. We also have shared resources that are shared across the entire agency. These include our systems infrastructure teams, our application development infrastructure teams, and they consist of system administrators, database administrators, our application development architects, our systems analyst, our information security analyst, and our computer operator. In addition to that, we have a help desk, and we have our research team, which is shared across all of the divisions.
So if you roll that up, this really is a graphical representation of our service delivery model and our organizational chart for IT. And you'll see, I think, that compared to most organizational charts, what's at the top are not the managers of functions, but the customers of those functions. And so so the way we've organized ourselves to do this business is to identify our customers in some groupings that largely tie around funding sources, and establish these teams using the functions that Sandy just talked about to provide more or less self-contained teams where that's appropriate for those functional customers, and then through a layer of governance, be able to deal with project prioritization, resourcing, accountability, and those sorts of issues, and share from a common project support structure. Sandy?
And the yep. Same question as last time: who's on that governance?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Riley. The governance structure is made up entirely of business representatives. Generally, it's the deputy administrators who are sort of the chief operating officers of each of our functional divisions. There are no IT staff directly on the governance boards. We have we'll come back to governance in a little bit. We have two governance subgroups: one that deals with the worker safety system, and one in the consumer protection area. The agency deputy director sits on both. As a crossover tie, and then Ms. Wheeler facilitates those meetings, but it's made up entirely of business.
So as we discussed on the diagram, you'll see that the upper half of the chart represent the folks that we talked about that support the day-to-day activity after the governance process. Then we have the project team supporting all the projects that go through that governance process. And then on the left are the shared resources that are shared across the organization. One of the things I wanted to note is the squares don't necessarily represent one person. So a business liaison may also act as the business analyst for that division, depending on the amount of work that those divisions and the amount of support that those divisions were looking for. Or a business analyst may also act as a system support specialist. But those teams do provide those functions or those services to those divisions. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Senator Whitson. Thank you. DCBS holds the fifth largest amount of delinquent liquidated debt among all the state agencies. And looking at this, I don't see a box here dedicated to your debt collection. Secretary of State's audit shows that you have the highest. DCBS has the highest write-off of debt in the among all the state among the top five state agencies. Uh-huh. So. I guess, again, I'd like to know what your amount of your debt is, whether it's growing, reducing, and the percentage of write-off.
Sure.
And actually, maybe you could address within that structure how you're going about collecting your bad debt.
Sure. Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, of course, this is the structure for our information systems, not for our shared services overall, and so our financial services include the collection functions that you're speaking of for...
You know, your IT is not collected, is not, your IT system is not hooked to your collection system?
No, we use IT services to do that, but there's not a dedicated piece of IT that's specifically related to debt collection. A couple of words about debt collection. Certainly, I'll need to get back to you with the specific details. A couple of things that are important to note about the nature of the debts that we have. First, we work in close partnership with the Revenue Department and regularly assign collection cases to them for work to be able to work on those debts. But we have some peculiar types of debt that help lead to the types of write-offs that we have. The most significant is in the area of non-complying employers for workers' compensation. The way we usually find out about a non-complying employer, someone gets hurt on the job, shows up at a hospital to be treated. They answer the question, yes, this was on the job, and it develops that it turns out there's not a workers' compensation policy in place for that individual. The worker benefit fund that I talked about can be used to provide bridge payments to deal with the actual medical expenses, but the non-complying employer, the employer that didn't have a policy, is directly on the hook not only for civil penalties but also for all of the actual medical and indemnity cases. And if you've been around a while, you know these.
I know it goes
these,
on forever.
Into some fairly large bills that you'll get constituent calls about.
You can't even get away from it by dying.
Sometimes, and they can be quite large particularly if it's a serious injury or a death or something along those lines. And statutorily, we have very little ability to go and negotiate a reduction on those costs. And the idea is to make sure that there's not an incentive for there being free riders in the system who decide to price into their products not having insurance. That generates a large amount of the debt that we carry on our books. The other area is in finance and corporate securities,
but you don't write that debt off. You don't write that debt off.
No, we do. There are times where we do write it off, but what we can't do is we can't negotiate it down with someone who we owe it to. We can negotiate down things like civil penalties, but the NCE, the actual indemnity costs and medical costs, we can write off. We talked about someone dying earlier. We can't actually write off debt in the case of no estate, no estate assets, those kinds of things. So we do write some of those. We do write some of those off.
Other than workman's compensation.
Finance and corporate securities would be the other area where we generate a fair amount of that. And there, what we are attempting to do frequently in the case of financial fraud, and financial fraud of the nature of someone who's out running a scam, a pyramid or a Ponzi scheme or something along those lines, we will frequently levy substantial civil penalties in the hundreds of thousands, or I've even seen a couple go by that were million-dollar civil penalties. Not so much because we think we're ever going to get $1 million out of that person, but because we want, frankly, the first thing to show up on a Google search of the person to be this monstrous civil penalty for whatever kind of a significant fraud they were engaged in. And very frequently, those are essentially uncollectible, and those would generate more of the write-offs, I think, that you're talking about over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And the other question I had, does your DCBS IT system interface with DAS?
Yes, Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, we have a mixed system that makes use of enterprise technology services through the state data center as well as services delivered.
Could you make available your state government service charges related to the enterprise system, the IT from DAS for 11, 13, 13, 15, 15, 17, and projected for 17, 19?
Certainly.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Nearman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Allen, I've seen research on a couple of slides there. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what kind of research services you do?
Sure. Do you want to? Okay. We have a small research staff that provides a variety of research services for their customers who are the units of the agency. The most significant is workers' compensation insurance. And so you'll frequently see, first of all, workers' compensation and safety certainly, but other portions of the organization as well are incredibly data-driven and data-dependent to make good policy decisions. Management Labor Advisory Committee is the advisory body that works with us on maintaining the integrity of the workers' compensation system, and there are really no significant policy issues that that body doesn't take up, that we don't develop extensive data to deal with. And what that means is we see the flow of claims data, for example, in workers' compensation. We see the flow of injury data through mandatory reporting on worker injury, and we use those data sets to be able to provide the information the organization needs to be able to operate. So, for example, an OSHA inspector doesn't show up at a business for no reason. We have a prioritization and a targeting system that tries to assure that we're not using precious inspector resource time to go to low-risk businesses, and that we are sending them to, for example, construction sites, which are much higher risk of injury. Same thing in terms of identifying claims payment data and practices by insurance companies, workers' compensation insurance companies. We use that data to manage those systems, and so those are the kinds of things that those research staff are engaged.
Thank you.
So let me just touch quickly. One of the metrics you asked us, I believe, to report on was our staff and budget allocation to IT functions. Staff is on the left. Budget is on the right. On the right, that's in terms of our all funds budget, which includes the non-limited funds. It would be equally fair to look at our IT investment as a percentage of the operating budget, which is about half, so the percentage would be about double. Looking at the all funds, that's not to say this is not a fair way. Either way, depending on the exact question you want to answer, would be appropriate. These numbers generally are consistent with Gartner metrics as reported in 2015 that we footnoted there at the bottom. Let me then turn in a little bit more detail and talk about
Senator Whitsitt.
Yes. Allen, your budget is almost all other funds, is that correct?
Almost entirely with a very small amount of federal funds, that's right.
That's primarily from fees, charges, licenses, and so forth to the business community.
That's correct. So our governance model is a bit complex. Unlike employment and other agencies that are more or less singularly focused on a broad set of missions with a sort of a single animating kind of a function, we as an agency really are sort of almost a holding company or an agglomeration of what were once upon a time independent agencies that have been merged over time, and the missions are somewhat different, and the funding sources are substantially different. On the left-hand side of this, you'll see we have a worker safety governance board, and this is the governance for IT investments for Oregon OSHA, the Workers' Compensation Division, and the Workers' Compensation Board. They share a single pot of money, which is the assessment on workers' compensation insurance premiums, and we allocate that across these functions, and it by design pays for that entire system. And so having governance within that limited set of resources for those functions that attach to those resources is sort of logical and self-contained as a way to approach those issues. On the right-hand side, although we have a single Consumer Protection Governance Board, those three divisions, Building Codes, Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and the Insurance Division, actually have almost what you would describe as an atomized set of funding sources. In particular, Building Codes and Division of Finance and Corporate Securities literally have dozens of individual statutorily dedicated funds that are quite narrow, that have one degree or another of restriction to their use. So, for instance, we have a statutory fee to charge pawnbrokers to be registered and regulated as pawnbrokers, and in general, we're able to take the money from pawnbrokers and run the pawnbroking program, but not use that money to deal with payday lenders. Now, I mean, there's a shared service level where that breaks down a little bit, and we deliver shared services to all of them, but that funding structure causes a little bit of a different discussion and a little bit different dynamic, particularly when you get into larger funding streams and programs and the needs of those programs. So to be able to have a kind of a like set of conversations, we've grouped them together for in that Consumer Protection Governance Board. Both of those then roll up into an agency-wide governance structure, which really is the merger of the two subsets that deal with agency-wide projects as well as anything that's a shared service project that would be ultimately used by both sets of divisions. So we'll spend just a minute talking about some past projects, and then I'll talk about those, and then Sandy will talk about currently in-flight projects. And I don't want to touch on all of these, but I do want to mention a couple because I think they're illustrative of some of the principles that I talked about early on. Building Codes Division is in, I want to say, year 7 of a planned 10-year rollout of a statewide online e-permitting system. This is certainly our largest IT project in recent memory in the agency. It's a 10-year, $50 million planned project to roll out a first-of-its-kind anywhere in the nation online building permit system so that a builder or homeowner trying to secure building permits doesn't need to figure out that they get the plumbing permit from the city, but they need to get the electrical permit from the county and have to drive from building to building, but is able to submit and conduct their business online electronically, submitting plans, making payments, managing their portfolio of permits in process. This is an example of an early project where we examined the notion of building our own purpose-built system for this and rejected that in favor of buying a commercial off-the-shelf COTS system to deliver this product. And in this case, one of the things that we were able to build into contract negotiation around this was to assure that the vendor had skin in the game for local cities and counties at their option adopting the system. And so there was a payment stream that went with each city or county coming on board. That meant that when we were done with the actual project in terms of making sure the portable's up and running and those kinds of things, there was still revenue on the table available to incent the contractor to work with us on system refinements, even if there wasn't necessarily a contractual obligation to do that, and it's worked very well. Workers' Compensation Board is a web portal, and this is an example of basically building a core infrastructure but then looking at enhancements to that as small self-contained pieces that get added to the system and are able to be quite manageable based on their scale and their interaction with the overall system. And then we've migrated to the along with a number of other agencies to the enterprise email system. This is not a huge project in terms of its impact budget-wise or anything like that, but I talked about all those legacy systems that we have to manage. Email's not a legacy system, to be sure, but it's one of dozens of systems that we, before migrating to the enterprise system, have had to manage. And so one of our philosophical steps has been to try to figure out how can we minimize and reduce the number of individual systems that we have to provide care and feeding to, because that takes resource away from other efforts.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. You mentioned that you were one of more than one agency that's migrated to this other sort of thing. I wonder if you are willing to comment more generally on what appears to be a little bit more willingness for agencies to think about the business of state government as a whole system rather than each agency doing its own thing. There's been something called the Executive Leadership Team, uh-huh. If I got the name right, and I remember we have visited about this on occasion sometime in the last few months. I was really encouraged to hear and see it in action. Is seeing that there was that migration, that one software migration, and a couple other things, is that sort of a one-time set of events that once you tackle the low-hanging fruit, it's done? Or is this a signal that your department, but other departments, just think about things a little bit differently now?
Yeah, Representative Senator Riley, I would say a couple of things. Certainly, the implementation over the last 3 or 4 years of an enterprise mentality for managing the organization that is state government in its broadest sense has resulted in significant changes to how all of us do business and how we approach different kinds of problems. So, on the one hand, putting on my enterprise hat, looking at enterprise email, if I got a really sharp pencil, I probably could have gotten whatever answer I wanted to get in terms of whether it really penciled out for me. You know, I probably could have come up with a plausible argument to say, gee, this makes no sense and I shouldn't do it. And I probably could have come up with a completely plausible answer to say, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread and I should do it. Because it was the kind of a decision that was really fairly close to the line. To me, there were two reasons that overrode that sharp pencil reason. One was that enterprise approach. wanting to recognize that there are things that in the aggregate are better delivered at the enterprise level than they are at the individual agency level. But even in a parochial sense, as I said, that was one more system on a long list of systems, and the opportunity cost of managing that system, I thought, helped argue strongly in favor of moving to enterprise solutions when they're available and effectively delivered and cost effective and all those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Yes, you say cost effective. I'm sure you penciled it out, but it would certainly seem that when you're anything to hook up to DAS anymore is pretty difficult to call cost effective. Its prices are going up quite rapidly. So.
Sure. Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, a couple of things about that. In terms of overall DAS service charge line items, of course, the biggest driver there is the recognition of a long period of deferred maintenance, mm-hmm. and the decision both to recover from that deferred maintenance but also operate on a pay-as-you-go model going forward, and that electing to do both those things as the enterprise has at this point is a pretty healthy hit for sure. In the area of enterprise email, however, that's a narrower cost per mailbox kind of a calculation, mm-hmm. around licensing and staffing, and really when we assessed it, I don't remember how the numbers exactly shook out, but they were very nearly identical numbers, and so it was not a case of something that we're, you know, to be a good team player, we're paying 30% more for our email than if we had delivered it ourselves by any means.
Thank you.
In looking at the projects for the next biennium, we have a few planned. First, for our workers' comp division, we're looking at a system that would allow an electronic data exchange, a secure method for our external entities to submit claims document. This was actually an application that was requested by our insurers, our self-insured, and our third-party administrators to be able to upload documents that they currently have to send by paper mail. We take those paper mail documents in and then scan them and then store them into their appropriate system. So we're looking at a system that allowed us to provide that service to our constituents. For the Workers' Comp Board, as Director Allen said, we continue to make enhancements to the portal project. For them, we're looking at several projects, all of them ranging from 100 hours to 400 hours. There's just continued improvements to that application. We also will continue to look at some of our legacy applications, converting them to a supportable platform, primarily .NET. We're looking for continued opportunities to migrate over to ETS services. So that's an area, as Director Allen was just talking about. And then, of course, one of the largest projects we have going on right now is the transition of Cover Oregon to DCBS, which we're going to talk about next.
As in right now. So as you can clearly see from this chart, this is a graphical representation of the cluster of IT systems that we will inherit. Yeah, I should have chosen my words a little better there. The set of IT systems that we will be inheriting from Cover Oregon, and I want to kind of give you a general orientation without going into this in great detail. The red ovals really are users of the system, and so on the left-hand side you see the public, but you see IT support staff, you see the Oregon Health Authority. You see the Cover Oregon Service Center. Basically, that's the notion of if there's a system out there, who is it that's using it, and ultimately, what are they doing with that system? The blue squares, which are largely centered to the upper right-hand side of the chart, are servers managed by Cover Oregon and Enterprise Technology Services staff. So those are boxes that exist in the state of Oregon. The yellow squares indicate hosted software as a service applications. Those are on the left-hand side. And you'll see that most of them also have a little red triangle in the bottom, and that means that's a system that once the switchover from Cover Oregon to DCBS for the marketplace functions occurs, those are systems that will be wound down and decommissioned. And so they're frequently things like mail or payroll or the kinds of systems that Cover Oregon needed as a freestanding, self-contained, independent business that will no longer need because those services will all be provided by existing state or DCBS services. The green boxes are Oracle-hosted systems about much, which much has been written and will be going forward, I'm sure. And then the red box over on the right-hand side is the federal hub, which really now is the is where customers are able to deal with their insurance issues.
So as we look at the systems, they'll actually, as Director Allen mentioned, fall into one of three categories. So as we look at each system, they'll either be migrated over to DCBS and be used as part of the systems that we support ongoing. They'll be migrated over for temporary use but decommissioned in the first quarter of 2016, or they'll be decommissioned immediately after the transition takes place, so looking at July 1st. All the systems that are decommissioned will need to be reviewed for data archiving rules, for records retention, or if there's litigation hold needs on them. We're actually in the process of looking for a quality assurance vendor to help us review all of our plans and ensure that we are compliant with any rules around those means. And then we've also hired in, as limited duration, four of the existing IT staff at Cover Oregon to help us understand the systems better and to help with the transition work.
I have a question.
Yes.
You're hiring four limited duration IT staff from Cover Oregon. Oregon Health Authority presented the other day with Ms. Miller, and they were suggesting that it was going to cost about $62 million to shift over to the Kentucky system. And that was in, as I might, as my understanding, that was in the OHA budget. So if you've taken over to Cover Oregon, this whole, I'm searching for the word.
I think I can help.
Okay.
Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, the best way to describe it is to tell a story that goes something like this. Once upon a time, we set up Cover Oregon to be the single entity that would take care of Medicaid enrollments and private health insurance enrollments with tax subsidies. And they went out and entered into a contract with a vendor to deliver a single system that would do all of that. And all of that included a customer-facing portal and a back end that Cover Oregon would use to manage all those people who were being routed either to the Oregon Health Plan through the Health Authority or to, as it turned out, about 13 private insurance companies on the qualified health plan side. Of course, the portal failed, and we went to a quote-unquote paper-based system for that 2014 plan year in late 2013. The vendor did deliver a back-end system of sorts that's a single back-end system that still is used today by Cover Oregon and OHA to do each of its respective pieces of the business. So the Medicaid qualification and enrollment process went back to the health authority as a function. Cover Oregon retained control of the system of dealing with private insurance companies for the qualified health plan system, but together the two agencies use that same back end. And so we're really talking about two bodies of work that need to occur going forward. OHA, using Medicaid dollars, will spend that $62 million to extricate itself from this single back-end platform and go to the Kentucky system for Medicaid. We, on the Cover Oregon side, have already extricated ourselves from the system for this year and going forward by using the federal platform to get people qualified and enrolled in private health plans. But we're still using the system today to manage work that we have to do related to that 1 year that we had that paper-based process. So right now, people are doing their taxes, they're dealing with 1095s, they've got questions about their 1095s, and we're using that back-end system at Cover Oregon to be able to go in and look at their records for that 1 year that that we signed up. That's work that will eventually wind down in some fashion, although it'll have something of a tail for a very long period of time since it's related to taxes. But that's part of those systems that will be wound down. So one system serving what was one agency, now one system serving two agencies, ultimately separating itself into two different systems to do two different functions. Is that helpful at all?
Follow-up so, is needed. Follow-up is needed.
So the $62 million for the OHA is going to take the Medicaid part of that function to OHA and keep it there and hook it into the Kentucky system. How much money is it going to cost DCBS to hook onto the federal platform? And I'm assuming now DCBS is going to have the primary function
of interfacing with the private insurance companies in an actual portal.
Yeah, so Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, actually on that last part, no, the federal platform interfaces with the carriers, and so we have now stepped out of things like dealing with carrier portal connection issues, dealing with commissions, all those kinds of things. That's all the responsibility of the federal portal. That federal portal was at no incremental cost to us for this for the year that we're in, or the plan year we're in right now. And the federal government has committed to us that it will again be available to us at no charge for the 2016 plan year, for which open enrollment will begin in November. After that, we don't know what the status will be going forward. There was a news story, I think last week, about New Mexico entering into a long-range agreement with the feds, and the dollar amount attached to that was fairly startling, something on the order of $20 million a year. My intent is for us to use this intervening year before we have to start thinking not about the 2016 plan year but the 2017 plan year to be able to identify what are the range of options available for us for a technology platform going forward, be that the federal platform at some sort of a known price, using some sort of a vendor solution that's out there, and this market is beginning to coalesce and turn into a regular COTS kind of a market, doing as OHA has done and partnering with Kentucky or some other state to use an existing platform. But I want to be able to come back at some point in about the next 12 or 18 months and articulate to you what our strategy is going forward for that. The good news is through various elements of Senate Bill 1, I think I need to come to each of your houses and have that conversation one by one individually with you. In terms of reporting, which is extensive and required in Senate Bill 1, and particularly, we don't have the financial resources in the budget, nor the statutory authority to do any sort of technology, have any sort of technology discussion with respect to marketplace functions without coming back and having extensive legislative engagement on that issue.
So, if I understand, then the OHA gets the Kentucky system for nothing, but it's going to cost them about $62 million to interface with it. You, DCBS, is getting the access to the federal platform, and you won't have any expense or any significant expense interfacing with the federal platform.
Not at this time, nor for the 2016.
Until they start holding it up in 2017.
Correct. And so we will almost certainly need to come back to you for some sort of authority on the expenditure side, certainly to be able to deal with that. Our budget is constrained enough that we really can't go out and spend a lot of technology money without that step.
Okay.
I mean, really, that to me, if I may, that was one of the selling points of Senate Bill 1, was bringing the whole operation back within state fiscal and budget control, and that notion that it's not enough for me to have the ability to raise the money. I've actually also got to have permission to spend it.
Yeah. And one final question, then. Will, you're going to bring four Cover Oregon part-time or not part-time, it's not the word I'm looking for, temporary employees. Are you bringing anybody from OHA, or are they going to keep all their own IT staff?
Co-Chairs, Senator Whitsitt, we're not bringing anybody over from OHA. We are working in close cooperation with them on these sets of issues because we right now live together in the same same system, and so that will continue throughout the time that we're doing this extrication of each other from this common system.
Mm-hmm. Well, my line of questioning was when we asked the Oregon Health Authority how much of that system was put together by their IT staff, Ms. Miller declined to answer the question on the basis of an ongoing lawsuit and advice of her attorney. And so I was wondering about the...
I would decline to answer on the basis of not having any idea what the answer is, which is much more straightforward, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anything more, Senator?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Continue. Let's see the last one.
Yeah. So in addition to the system work that we have to do, we also have to review the Cover Oregon IT licensing contracts. So those that we carry forward, we'll make sure they're in compliance with what our contracting folks are telling us, but we'll also envision canceling a lot of those contracts as we decommission the systems. We'll be looking at the Cover Oregon IT policies, make sure that our DCBS policies align with what they were looking for and fill in any gaps. We also are required as part of the work that we're taking over to provide IT audit information to our federal partners. So we'll be doing that in the necessary reporting, which will be new for our organization. And then, as you mentioned, we also have interagency agreements and data use agreements that we're working on right now with OHA to ensure that we are sharing that system fairly and that we're all getting what we need out of the system to carry our business forward. So lastly, this is just really an overview of all the work that we see coming our way. From an IT perspective, we obviously still have work happening at Cover Oregon, so we have IT staff there through July 1st that will be supporting their ongoing work through that time. For the last 4 months, we've been working on the planning, trying to understand their systems, gathering information about who uses those systems, and really the driver for that big, ugly, colorful chart that you saw first. Now we're getting into the detailed transition work, developing detailed plans. What will the steps be that we'll take to decommission the systems, to save the data that needs to be saved? Where will it be stored? How long will it need to be stored? Those kind of things. We also are in the process of building the marketplace technology at DCBS. So the technology that's going to be used going forward needs to stand up at ETS and be connected over at the L&I building. So that work is happening right now. And then, of course, the ongoing work that's going to support the marketplace. So we anticipate adding two additional staff to help us with that work. One will be the business liaison, which we've talked about, to support the day-to-day operations, and then a third-party administrator to help us support the third-party COTS applications that we'll be bringing over. Starting on July 1, the big lift will be that archiving and decommissioning of all those systems. We anticipate that's going to take us through June of next year. We see about 12 months worth of work there. And then lastly, the IT security work. So envision looking at our policies, making sure that we're in compliance with what's required by our federal partners in this area, as well as looking at the records retention rules and the data security to ensure everything that we do have to store for a long period of time is protected and safe. So that's a short list there, but it's a lot of work for us.
Senator Whitsitt.
So it's my understanding that much of the work of Cover Oregon was being done by hand on paper, and that there were somewhere between 100 and 200 employees that were temporary employees doing all that work. Are those people still working somewhere, or is this process now functional electronically where there's being done that way? Where are we in that process? And
sure.
If we still have 200 employees, who's paying them?
Sure. Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, so the answer generally is no, those employees no longer exist. That paper-based process for which extensive additional staff were brought in at both OHA and at Cover Oregon was for the 2014 plan year, and so really it was through the full extended open enrollment period that went until, I want to say, about April to get people enrolled in the system. Over time, that staff ratcheted down, and what they were doing when we talk about paper system, they were taking things that were completed on paper or on a fillable form on the web by consumers and keying that stuff into that back-end system that I talked about. Once that data was in for that plan year, it was in and there was no further paper-based work to do. It was in an automated system to be used on a go-forward basis. For 2015, the open enrollment period that began in October, that made use of the federal platform, and that was an automated process, and so there was no set of staff to have to manage a paper-based process, and that would be the same going forward. Today, Cover Oregon has been implementing a reduction in force plan. They currently have about 100 staff on hand. Later this month is a major step down in that staffing. The expectation is that at June 30th, there would be approximately 41 staff in place at Cover Oregon who would be laid off. We are in the process right now of standing up the permanent and temporary staff at DCBS to take over those marketplace functions. The permanent staffing are about 15 people. And then we're, as Ms. Wheeler said, we're bringing over a 3 FTE of technology staff. We're also bringing over 13 call center staff on a one-year limited duration basis, again, to deal with things like questions about tax reports and those sorts of things based on their familiarity, not just with the subject matter, but also the back-end systems that they need to be able to use to access information. So we'll have a staff short-term of about, if I can do math quickly in my head, about 30, call it somewhere around 35. And then at some point, we're required to have a call center going forward. We don't have any basis to be able to tell you today what we think that call center staffing needs to be, so we would likely be coming back in February when we do have enough information to look to keep some portion of those 13 positions permanently, but I expect it to be quite small.
One other question. I think I heard you say that the next open enrollment period starts October 15th, 2015.
I believe it's November 1st, but yes.
And then what is in place now that wasn't in place before that will keep you from having to have those employees keying in all that stuff that comes in into the call center?
Sure, Co-Chair Senator Woodsett. So they weren't required in this last open enrollment period. It was the open enrollment period before that when our portal failed. Yeah. So what's in place now is the federal portal, which consumers are able to use.
The federal portal works.
Yes. Yes, and the key difference is last year, everyone had to go through the federal portal again to get into that system. Now they're in that system, and so staying with an existing company choice will be quite a bit simpler. But both last fall and this coming fall, there's not a need for that staff ramp up for the paper-based system.
Thank you.
So, yes, Representative Nierman.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll try to be quick here. On the previous slide there, so you've got quite a lengthy period of archive and decommission there. What's how many people are going to be involved in that process, sir?
We have the four limited duration employees that we're bringing over from Cover Oregon, as well as we have two folks right now that are helping me on the transition team, and then we'll pull in DCBS IT resources as we need them. We also envision partnering with the Secretary of State, since they're the experts on records retention, and so we'll be working with them, as well as the DOJ, the Department of Justice, helping us on the litigation hold information. So I think we'll be tapping into resources not just within DCBS, but also partner agencies that are experts in this area.
Can I follow?
Sure.
Is that what's driving this, the litigation? I don't want to get the lawyers involved here, but is that what's driving this, the litigation, or is it just that you feel like you have to keep the health records?
It's actually both. There's obviously the litigation as well as records retention laws. So some of this information has to be, actually a big chunk of this information has to be retained for at least 10 years. So, and that's just Oregon State records retention rules.
Just as as an example, we'll be decommissioning PeopleSoft, which Cover Oregon uses to manage things like payroll records. Well, we need to maintain those payroll records and have access to them going forward, but we don't need licenses and servers to deliver PeopleSoft, as an example. So those are the kinds of things we'd be archiving.
So the licenses go away then?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that a year and a half then? Because I see there's that date out there, but it's kind of hovering on over December 1st, 2015, but it says 2016.
That's correct. So we won't be able to start decommissioning until July 1st when we actually do the transfer. Until then, the Cover Oregon staff are still using the system. So we're looking at about 12 months worth of work. So,
and you were saying it was six FTEs plus some other people involved,
right,
or something?
That is correct.
Okay. All right.
So I think that wraps it up. Thank you very much for your information, and I'm going to adjourn.
I want to keep that.